So, is this working? Yeah. So for today's exciting 1 hour talk, this talk today will be about insight practice. Because shouldn't really need to talk about it because it's part of everything else, but nevertheless, sometimes people have separated that out to think of it as a different type of meditation, but it is just part of everything else. So, and already people have asked the questions, are we supposed to do samatha first and then do vipassana, or vipassana first and then do samatha, do them both together, or how should we do things? It gets very confusing. But you will find that samatha and vipassana will always go together. That's what Ajahn Chah kept on telling me. And that's what I've been practicing, and that seems to be, when I look at the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, that's how the Buddha taught. And how do we know we're doing insight vipassana? Because if we really see things clearly, it means the problems drop away. In other words, the sign you're doing insight is you become calm. And what's the sign of calm? The sign of becoming calm and peaceful is you get this incredible mindfulness and insight starts to come. So insight is what produces calm. Calm is what produces insight. They always go together. And that brings me on to one of my favorite quotes from the Dhammapada. Nati janang apanyasa panya nati ajayato yam hi janang cha panya cha sawe nibbana santike, which you all know, you all Pali experts. And I just do that to impress people because, you know, sometimes we say Ajahn Brahmi just teaches pop Buddhism. You know, two bad bricks in a wall, and you want the real stuff. Now, first of all, just because you can understand it does not mean it's not deep. Because I used to do that, go to these talks, and they're totally incomprehensible, and we go on afterwards, what do you reckon about that? Oh, that was so deep. I couldn't understand it, so it must have been profound. It was really gobbledygook. But later on, that's when, you know, when you started to question things and look at life and have a wider experience. And I came across this great saying from Werner Heisenberg, who was the great quantum physicist. And Werner Heisenberg, you know, people always say that quantum physics is one of the most difficult, profound of subjects in science. But he was quoted as saying that if you really understand quantum science, then you'll be able to explain it to the person serving you a beer in the pub, and they will understand it. In other words, your ability to explain it and have people understand it is a sign that you've understood it yourself. And if it's gobbledygook, it means you don't understand it either. And I always was really impressed with that saying by Werner Heisenberg. And that was probably why there were so many people in the pubs around his university who were really great quantum physicists. So, anyway, so you should be able to explain it, you know, pretty easily. And you know, as far as the Nati Jananga Panyasa meant, it means there is no jhana without wisdom, without panya. There is no wisdom without jhana. That's the second line. But where there's wisdom and jhana, you're in the presence of nibbana. A wonderful little saying there. No jhana without wisdom, no wisdom without jhana. And when you've got the both together, you know, you're right close to nibbana. Well, that's a powerful little teaching there. And of course, the reason you say it there, because you know, the insight, the wisdom, they come together with the stillness, the calmness. They work together. So in your meditation practice, you have a little bit of stillness and then some insight, Then insight will make the wisdom deeper, and then wisdom will make the stillness deeper. They always work together. And you can't have one without the other. An example. But when you are meditating, you know that sometimes you come up, oh, I'm not getting anywhere, I come across a block, things aren't happening. So you've got a choice, you can push through. Just sit there. Yeah, I'm not going to move until I get to the next stage. And many of you have done that. It's called like the enlightenment or bust. You always bust. Never seen anyone get through that way. So that's just busting. And again, one of those monks, he, good friend, still a monk, but he decided to again sit all night through pain, just watch the sensations come and go. And in the morning, we had to take him to hospital. Double knee reconstruction. He wrecked his knees. Another monk, one of the first monks who ever went to England, you know, he decided, he read in the sutras, just cold, it's just the sensation. And in the time of the Buddha would just use three robes. And so he decided to go up on Hampstead Heath in the middle of the winter, in the snow, and sit there all night. And of course, same thing happened to him in the morning, to the hospital, had severe pneumonia. Now, these are real cases. And what was the first thing the Buddha taught after his enlightenment? Middle way. Avoid those extremes. But people think, oh no, I'm going to really go for it. I'm going to kick butt. You know what happens when you kick butt? You get a sore ass. Or a sore foot, depending on which end you're at. So that, now honestly, that is not the way. I'm not trying to put other people down, but that seems to be the tendency of people in our world. If they want something, they just force themselves. They're going to get it no matter what. They're aggressive. That is not the way this works. If you get in any problem in the meditation, just force. It's going to be counterproductive. Instead, we use a thing called wisdom power, insight. Stand back and say, what's happening here? It's just like that sometimes that all my silly mistakes which I make. So that once I had a problem, it wasn't actually a meditation problem, it was when I was having a cup of coffee at Penang Airport. And it was this really delicious, milky coffee. I don't know what it actually was, you know, but it was really nice. And it had a straw in it, and I was sucking through the straw, but the straw was blocked. So what did you do? Straw was blocked, so suck harder. And all my so-called disciples, they weren't telling me what I was doing. They were just holding their hands over their mouth, trying their hardest not to laugh. Because when I found out, it wasn't a straw, it was actually a spoon. Those are plastic spoons. You know, which just looked like a straw. The first time I come across these things, when I went to coffee shops or tea shops, they had a spoon. Now, they're the metal ones you have in there. You know, not just these plastic ones with a tiny little thing on the end to stir things up with. Now, that was got into big trouble. Well, not really big trouble. They laughed as soon as I saw what I was doing. I could see the signs that there was something wrong. Just more power. I'm going to suck this no matter what. Of course it doesn't work. That's using that force in your meditation. You stand back and look, there's something wrong there. They're laughing. And you take it out. Yeah, it's not a straw after all. So anyway, that's an example of using insight rather than force. Because when you actually say, oh, this is really stupid, what are they this for? And so what we do, we just stand back. What's going on here? Because you find that the typical simile of hitting your head against a brick wall. That's what, you know, sometimes it's like in meditation. And what's happening here? What do? You don't try and hit your head harder against a brick wall. Because look, you know, you've been around long enough now. What is harder, a brick wall or your head? You don't need to have sort of a PhD in anatomy or medicine to know that, you know, you're not going to break through with your head. Even though sometimes people have got pretty, you know, tough nuts, but they can still go. So what do? Instead of banging your head again and again against a brick wall, you do, you stand back. Stand back and have a look, what's going on? And you stand back to get some in the bigger picture, a bit of insight. Ah, there's a door just over there to the right. There's a ladder to the left. I don't need to keep banging. I just go a bit to the right and then go through the door. Easy. So this is actually what we do when we get stuck in meditation, or no, even starting meditation. Own personal history, insight, and just the how it really helps the meditation. There was time when I started meditation, I was really into it. But you know that what life does, you know, you have work, you have girlfriends, you know, you have stuff to do, you have concerts, which are really more important than the meditation retreats to go and attend. Typical young guy. And then, I don't know where this was, I think it could have been in India, but I had a cup of coffee in a shop, and just, you know, being a young guy, you know, you go and talk to anybody, and there was this French man I was talking to. Now, I don't know if, I've mentioned this story quite a few times, if ever he hears this, come and say hello, and I'll shake your hand and thank you. Because I was saying, yeah, I was really into meditation a couple of years ago, but, you know, it's just there's other things to do. And he said, well, what are you giving up meditation for? And I said, well, I'm not really getting anywhere. And he gave this wonderful piece of advice, which I share with you. And I teach this, and I do it myself. He said, at the end of the meditation, you know, before you come out of meditation, just pause for 2 or 3 minutes and just, you know, do it almost like a debriefing. How do I feel? Don't just get up and go away. How do I feel now? Is my body more relaxed? Is my mind more peaceful? Especially, you know, more peaceful than when I started, more relaxed when I started. You know, what worked, what didn't work? And I started doing that. And I wonder what I found. I thought, no, it's not really getting anywhere. But it was. It was getting a long way. But I wasn't really looking at that. I was just doing the meditation. Okay, done now. And off doing something else. But as soon as I paused to see the result, it was really easy to see that this was working. In a half an hour, 40 minutes, whatever it was far more peaceful. And I could feel that. I could know it for myself. So just that little pause at the very end. They call it a debriefing. How do you feel after half an hour's meditation? And because I paused to check, it actually encouraged me. It was actually working. And I just wasn't noticing it. And there was, it's very hard to get into the Rains retreats here, but we usually have about 12, 15 people allowed to come and stay here for the whole 3 months, Rains retreat. And there was this one guy staying here. And then he just got a bit sort of bit fed up halfway through meditation. Oh, I'm not getting anywhere, and so I had to get a skillful means to help him. And my skillful means was we needed something from the shopping centre for the kitchen or something, so I sent him to Armadale Shopping Centre to get some stuff. Only about one shop, and when he came back, he said, "That's crazy out there. That's madness in a shopping centre." It was so just, yeah, now you can actually see how far you've come. I said, wow, yeah, that's true. Because, you know, that was the place he used to hang out in, you know, when he was, before he came on retreat. But, you know, after about, you know, 5 or 6 weeks on retreat, he'd calmed down so much, but he didn't realise how much peace and stillness he had. It was only when I sent him out that he thought, wow, this is crazy. Therefore, he realized how much progress he was making. So be careful there, because sometimes we don't notice now how much progress we're making unless we pause to stop and look and get insight. It encourages us. And any problems we have, see, what are we doing? Not force, but using some wisdom power. And I'm trying to give all this wisdom power to you, but you don't need to sort of remember it. This is, again, the great thing which, you know, it surprised me, but, you know, this is how the human mind works. You experience this for yourself. You don't need to believe me. that sometimes you are meditating, you do come across a problem. And then what do? And then you think, oh, just two bad bricks in the wall, or open the door of your heart. And you say, where the heck did I get that one from? And you actually realize that, you know, you hadn't formally remembered it or kept it in mind. It just comes up at the right time. And that's where, you know, the simile of the, as I mentioned yesterday's talk about the Nimittas, the simile of the still forest pool. Ajahn Chah used to say that, about just, you know, just going off into the jungles and just, when he sat perfectly still, he saw these animals come out to play. But, you know, at the time when I first was with Ajahn Chah, it just made no sense to me. But later on, when you were meditating and you get some Nimittas and then they disappear again, that instruction just came up all by itself. It was years since I listened to it. And that's actually the way the mind works. That's why I do call it brainwashing. You know, you put these incredible, wonderful seeds in it, and when that sort of little instruction is required, it's almost like it resonates and just it comes up, like the antiviruses in computer. It just comes up, oh yeah, this is what I should do. And that is all you needed to do. You know, for the insight to get you into the deeper stages of meditation. You saw, you know, the nimittas coming and going all over the place. They come a little bit and then they disappear. Or a common problem, which, you know, many people have, nimittas up in the corner somewhere. And a nice nimitta, and you go look at it and it runs away. Just like an animal just poking its head out of the bush. And is she ready for me? No, could you go looking for it? So, though, when those things happen, you remember, oh, Ajahn Chah, still forest pool. So you sit there, okay, I'm not moving. Pretend to be still, silent, not moving at all. And then, you know, some of these trainings, they really help in many other professions. There was this one guy, you know, he's a Buddhist, he's married to a Thai girl, and he was a reporter, a photographer for the Sunday Times in Perth. It's not the most, well, it's okay, I don't think you mind, not the most high-class newspaper, but, you know, it's a newspaper, the local rag for a Sunday. And his editor said there was a rumour going around, only a rumour, that, you know, the celebrity pop singer Kylie Minogue, you know, was having some problems in her career, and she was hiding out in Cable Beach Resort in Broome, and that's out West Australia. It was only a rumour, and of course you can't confirm it, but, you know, she was a world celebrity. So they said, you know, do you want to go up to Broome just to check it out? Beautiful place, you know, all the fares paid for. Yeah, I'll do that. So off he went, you know, up to Cable Beach Resort. And of course you can't just, you know, knock at the receptionist, is Kylie Minogue here? You know, because if she is, you know, she's incognito, she's hiding. So instead, he crawled through the bushes, you know, with his camera. He said, you know, you don't really get the chance to be a paparazzi in Perth that often, but this was it. And he crawls through the bushes and looking at the cottages and seeing if anything was happening. And then he saw this person come out of the cottage. And he recognized it was actually her, it was Kylie Minogue. And this was his biggest moment as a press photographer ever. This, and it's in Perth, okay, this is not in LA or sort of London or somewhere. This, he didn't want to blow it. And so he got out his camera and just remembered the story of the still forest pool. Because if he moved or made a noise, she'd see that and she'd run away. So it doesn't just work for nimittas, it works for all sorts of other sort of parts of your life. But he got the snap, he got the photograph. And of course, you know, well, you know, sometimes you say it's a bit immoral or something because people are having trouble, they need their space. But, you know, that's, you know, part of the job and that's part of her life. So anyway, he said, most exciting moment of my life. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for helping me. But anyhow, that's, you know, just the insights, you know, which comes up just at the right time you need it. Now, one of those other insights which, you know, which comes up, which really helps, and it's, you can see this is not force, it's using wisdom power. And that was that incredible simile from Ajahn Chah. You know, sometimes you look at your teacher and say, what similes were his best? And must admit that this was one of the most powerful ones, because when I first heard it, it was just when I first went to stay with him. And so, you know, when I heard this, I really thought it was rubbish, it was crazy. Made absolutely no sense to me. Right, some of the things I'm saying to you, you think, oh, that's crazy, that doesn't make any sense. He's just attached to jhanas, or he's just too lazy, he's just too slack. I want the real practitioners. Bring out the Zen stick. But anyway, this is what he said. And, you know, the weighty thing is, after he told the story, I just dismissed it. And I just forgot it. Literally years, 10, 15, 20 years, I don't know how much. Until a certain time in the meditation, just, it helped me enormously. And just how amazing that simile was. And that was a simile of the mango orchard. And he said that his monastery, Wat Pa Phong, was a mango orchard, with the mango trees parted by the Buddha. And because of the great compassion of the Buddha, he said, you know, you don't need to climb the trees to get the mango. In fact, if you climb the trees, you'll never be able to reach the mangoes. You know, throw a stick up at it, they won't sort of fall. You shake the tree, that's not the way to get them. They never had cherry pickers in those days, but that won't work either. He said, there's only one way to get those mangoes on the trees grown by the Buddha. And they're just so sweet and so juicy. And there's thousands of them, he said. Enough for everybody. But there's only one way you can get those mangoes. You have to sit perfectly still under the mango tree. Perfectly still. Hold out your hand and a mango will fall right into your hand. Now to me, at that stage of my practice as a monk, absolutely, that was bunkum. It didn't fit with my experience. I knew mango trees. You know, if you sat under it and waited, you'd probably wait for about 5 or 6 days before the first mango would fall. And if it did fall, it would fall on your head, not on your hand. I mean, this, what rubbish talk is that? So I just pushed that aside. And then, of course, afterwards, having shaken the Bodhi tree too many times, try to climb up it, try to jump up, throw things at it to get something. Nothing ever worked. You try really hard, extra hours meditating, come on, you can do it. Okay, today is the day. Okay, none of this sleepy business. I'm not even going to eat. I'm going to sit here all day. I don't care if I get paid for it, I'm just going to go for it. So anyway, so having done that too many times, you know, that you realize that nothing was working. So instead you just sat perfectly still. Pop, pop, pop. You experience that, it's crazy at first. Why is it when I try so hard, I don't get anything? When I just sit perfectly still, opening your hand is opening your heart. Kindness, opening the door of your heart. So allow things to come in. And then all these great insights come, one after the other. Only when you're still. You shake the tree, nothing happens. You've all done that, haven't you? But these are insights. And they really sort of strike you. Wow, this is amazing stuff. And you probably forget that, but later on in your life you'll be sitting there doing nothing and then, hang on, I heard this somewhere. That's where it comes out. That's how the insight really happens. So you know it's insight because it just takes you to the next level. Often, like for me, it's just the insight is, why is it sometimes, for those who really know their Buddhism and they've studied and they've gone to many lectures, they've even written books on it, just why is it when they meditate they do one thing, and when they, you know, outside of meditation they do another thing? they're so kind, you know, to others, you know, the daily life, always looking after each other, making sure you've got enough food, making sure, you know, if someone's sick, are you okay today? People are just so kind. When it gets to the no, come on, I've got an ache of it. No, do not move. You got an itch? No, I'm not going to scratch. Have you ever noticed that people's attitude in meditation is really tough? They would never treat another person like that. In meditation, they treat themselves like it. So there's a disconnect there between the practice and your understanding. So we start to get our understanding and apply it to our practice. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Come on, that's just being lazy. But you ask other people to do that. Take a break. You know, you're hurting. You're tired. I've seen you meditating. You know, your head is drooping all the time. Take a break. No, not me. I'm a tough meditator. I'm not going to. But no, you say it to other people, please do it yourself. And it's just so powerful. So you make peace, you be kind, be gentle. The law of karma. That's just a basic teaching of Buddhism. Even if you're not Buddhist, people believe in karma. You know, just cause and effect. Actually, an interesting little side story here. We're talking, a couple of days ago, about sort of weird stuff, about psychics, mediums, believing in dreams, you know, the five angels, you know, stuff like that. But you know that there was this really powerful medium. And his name was Edgar Cayce, Cayce. And he was in the east coast of the United States between the wars. I think in the 1930s, he really became quite well known. Because he was this devout Baptist, very strong Christian, but, you know, he would go in a trance, and in a trance, you know, someone would come to him and say, you know, I'm really sick, I'm dying, doctors can't do anything to me, and in the trance, he'd say, take this medicine. And it was really strange medicines, sometimes in just doses which were just, you know, so ridiculous. But it would work. People were cured. And reading his book, which was really good fun to read, that one of the cures, they brought this person to him, and he said, this is the medicine you need, this will cure him. He's in a trance, okay? He's not a normal self. And so they went to the drugstore and hadn't heard of that medicine. And I've, you know, been in the business for a long time. I didn't know what you're talking about. There's no such medicine. So they put him back in trance. He said, not in the local drugstore. You find it in a drugstore in St. Louis. No, I think in Virginia Beach or something on the Atlantic coast. In St. Louis you'll find it. No emails in those days. Had to go to the telegraph office and send a telegram. Instead of an hour later, the telegram came back. Haven't heard of it in the drugstore. So they put him in trance again. And they said, it's in that drugstore, in the back room, the third shelf on the right, to the left. And I sent that telegram, and the telegram found it. It was weird stuff, but you know, it's true. But the amazing thing is, he was a devout Christian, and one day, in trance, they were messing around, just asking all sorts of questions. What's the most important law in the universe? And remember, he was a devout Christian in the 30s, and he shot back the law of karma. And when he came out of meditation, he was just, what did I say? Out of trance. Don't put me in trance again, that's evil. Or whatever. That's what he said. He reconciled later on by the fact he's, you know, doing so much good work and helping so many people, that can't be anything bad. But anyway, he had those amazing things about the law of karma, the most essential teaching. And why don't we do that with our meditation? Have the insight that meditation is also subject to the law of karma. So what are you doing right now? Are you making good meditation karma or bad meditation karma? Do you want to develop the meditation to get peaceful and bright and enlightened? So, law of karma. If you are fighting the mind, being aggressive, being mean, being violent, or like wanting and craving something, that is called bad karma. You're not going to get anywhere except just more suffering and more tense. So look at your mind like you'd look at a cat, or just look at the little snake, or look at sort of the little millipedes. Maybe that was the baby snake, and maybe that's what happens when they grow up. The millipedes become big snake. I think that's the case. No, of course not. But anyway, you wouldn't tread on those on purpose, but you tread on defilements or anything you want to try and get rid of. And sometimes we look at our mind just like our slave. You know, we abandoned slavery a long time ago in the Western world, but we still enslave our mind, tell it what to do. We still mistreat and abuse our body. It's bad karma. That is why we don't get any progress in our meditation. So, you know, what is good karma? That's why I keep on saying making peace, being kind, being gentle. That's good karma. You can never go wrong with that. So he's sitting here, really tired. Make peace, be kind, poor thing. You know, you must have been having a hard day or going through some physical stuff or not used to the weather or the food or whatever. Oh, poor thing. Take a break. Be kind. That's what the teddy bears are here for. Even though sometimes you mistreat it. I see the teddy bear over there. I don't know if it's very happy in that position. But, you know, it's not complaining, so it should be okay. Look at this poor teddy bear. Squashing it to death, it can't breathe. But anyhow, it does teach you some good karma. Do that to yourself. It's not that you're hugging the teddy bear. The teddy bear's hugging you. It's not you're comforting the teddy bear. The teddy bear's comforting you. So in other words, we're making some good karma, and that is going to work. So we learn how to make peace with our mind. Be kind, be gentle. I told you that story of the sexy thoughts. I also told you the story of the anger-eating monster. You can see that's good karma stories. And they just putting your hand out, sitting under the mango tree, that's being patient. There are two types of patience. And this is what you find in insight. You look at what's going on, what works, what doesn't work. The two types of patience. The first type of patience is waiting for something to happen. It hasn't happened yet. Ajahn Brahm has told me if I just let go and hug a teddy bear, sit still, hold my hand out, something's going to happen. Fraud. It doesn't happen. I've been waiting for something to happen. That is not patience. That's wanting. Wanting for something to happen in the future. Not present moment awareness, is it? So instead of wanting to something to happen, which is impatience, it's never going to work that way. We wait in this moment. Or just like I say, like a waiter in a restaurant, you wait on the customer now. So you're always looking to see what they need. It's waiting in the moment, not waiting in the future. If you understand that, you understand why sometimes people get frustrated. They think they're being patient, they're not. They're waiting for something to happen. So you have this confidence. You can wait in this present moment. You know that if you're making good karma, it's going to happen. And now we come to the story about impatience, which is actually a bona fide joke, but it all came about because trying to teach people how to be patient, about a refugee who came to Australia, and in his home country, oh, he was just very prominent, highly skilled, but those qualifications were not recognised in Australia. You know what Australia is like sometimes? You know, someone told me this story. It's just absolutely ridiculous. It's supposed to be advanced countries, but there was in the College of Psychiatry in Australia, they decided to invite this prominent psychiatrist from the United States, really, really famous. And when they invited him to come and lecture in one of the universities in Australia, they said, well, you know, because, you know, you're highly qualified, but, you know, you can't even teach over here until that you are accredited. So you have to do a couple of exams, first of all. Yeah, what? You know, you invite, I'm a professor. You know, I'm a teacher. You want to examine me? He said, well, you know, you have to, because it's, you know, the unions and the laws and stuff. Like, oh, it's ridiculous. Okay, what do I have to study? And I gave him two books. And he looked at the first book. Whose name is on that? It's my name. I wrote the book. But still, he had to study the book he wrote and write an exam on it. Oh, it's crazy stuff sometimes. Anyhow, and he had to do it. He had no choice. It's regulations. Anyway, so where was I going with this? I should have laughed so much. The trouble is, I live in the moment so much. I forgot what I really do. Let go of the past. You see, I know. What was I talking about the refugee? Yes. Okay. Very good. Yeah. So even though he was really highly qualified, the only job he could get was a labourer on a building site. And he was, you know, quite a fit guy and very strong, so he worked really hard. And when he came home the first day, on Monday, his wife said, oh, how'd you go? He said, oh, yeah, I worked really hard. How much did you earn? He said, nothing. They didn't pay me at all. A bit strange. But he went to work the next day. He worked even harder. Still, he never got paid. He was getting very upset, you know, Australians exploiting refugees. He worked even harder on Wednesday and Thursday. He just didn't really want to go to work at all, but he went there and worked his butt off and really hard and still got no money. So, right, that's it. I'm not going to go to work anymore. They exploit refugees in Australia. It's really unfair. I'm not going to go to work. Never again. Not in this country. And then his wife said, oh, come on, Friday, get out of my space. You go to work anyway, got nothing else to do. So off he went to work on a Friday. He didn't work that hard at all. And he got this big pay packet. Lots of money. When he went home, he was very happy. He said, I finally figured out how it works in Australia. From today on, I'm only going to go to work on Fridays. Do you understand why it's about meditation? We always want to get payday, don't we? The big meditation. Oh, yeah, I got the nice nimittas, oh, who knows, even jhanas. Oh, this is really good. And you want it the next day as well. The next meditation. And the evening. And the night time. And the morning. You want it again and again and again. You've got to go to work. Build up your karmic credits. Until you get so much. Whoa. You get your paycheck, now you've got to go back to work again. That's the way it works. Because you've got to learn how to make peace, be kind, be gentle, to let go. And if you do that enough times, it's good karma, good meditation karma. It's only a matter of time. You're going to get a paycheck. It's already in the mail for many of you. So this is actually how this beautiful thing works. And as you can see, it's getting better and better, and then every now and again you get a really nice big one. Because you've let go, you've been kind, you've been gentle. And that's like the wisdom we get. And the underlying stuff about this is, as I mentioned the first night, the Second Noble Truth Meditation. Second Noble Truth Meditation, want, causes suffering. So if you're suffering, if you're frustrating, oh, this isn't working, there's coming here, they say, oh, I'm sure everyone else has got jhana, but not me. It really sucks, I don't want this place anymore. Why? I'm always a failure, I can't do anything. Listen, if you're suffering, it's not because there's something wrong with you. It's not because there's something absent or there's something missing in you. I mentioned it, everybody's got that Buddha mate, got that jhana inside your lotus. It's just you don't get it how to open it up. Just don't want anything. Sit here, this is good enough for me. That's why I put that poster out on the kitchen. I want happiness. First mistake, I. Spiritual materialism, I
want the jhana. I want the enlightenment. I want the bliss. It's all about I. Even just the problems with high tech, iPhone, iPod, iPad. It's all about I, isn't it? That's why even these days, later on, I refuse to get involved in a selfie with you. We don't believe in selfies. If it's weefies, okay, I'll do a weefie with you. But not a selfie. We don't believe in self. Those selfies, okay. Yeah, weefies. Yeah, no, yeah, well, part of that. If I call it weefies, that's much my... Just like also in the retreat centres, that sometimes when you get your lunch, do you, is it self-service? Not if you're enlightened. If you're enlightened, you can't do the self-service line anymore. There's another line for you, no self-service. I'm messing around. But, and it's all about I, and then want, happiness. If there's an I, if there's a want, there'll be no happiness. If there's no I, no want, that's all that's left is happiness. So, what I've been doing for so many years, I come across the block in meditation, you know, you're getting there and just ask, what do I want? Just a slight little interference any time. Not much. I don't go into a big philosophical treatise of what do I want, why do I want it, and what is wanting anyway, and what actually wants this candle or that candle, or what is actually, you know, that just goes into a big monologue. I just interrupt, just one word, what do I want? There's always something there which you want, which stops you letting go. And as soon as you see that, that's it. And you don't have to get rid of it. As soon as you notice it, it vanishes and you just start going deep again. That's all it is, just a want. So that's what I've used a lot. Looking there, what is it I want? Got you. And then you just go deep. You pass through it straight away. In the suttas, in Buddhist meditation, they have this symbol of Mara. Mara is a control freak. Always trying to get you to want something. And you see that, I see you, Mara. This is one of the reasons why we chose the suburb for our city centre. No, lack, Mara. Lack is like it's in Malaysia, Singapore. You know, always add on to, you know, Nola. You know that, don't you? How are you going, lack? Good on you, lack. So it literally means no, Mara. That's why it's a great place to meditate there. In No Mara, city centre. Anyway, that's the wanting stuff, which has no end to it. Okay. Okay. The origin of materialism. Not just ordinary materialism, spiritual materialism. And this just happened to be a story of a bhikkhuni. It could have been a bhikkhu, a monk. But, so it's not putting down the nuns. But there was once this nun who lived in a cave. Really peacefully, simple living nun. And she would go on alms round every morning and just get enough food to eat so she can go back to her cave and meditate. And every now and again teach some Dharma to the people. But when she came back from alms round, she found that one of her spare robes had a hole in it. There was a mouse in the cave, and the mouse was chewing her robes. And so she got a patch out and sewed her robe. And as she was sewing this robe and noticing all the other patches on her robe from when the mouse had chewed her robes before, she thought, this is just so much bother having to sew my robes because this stupid mouse. Now I'm fed up with just doing all this. And she had this insight. Why don't I get a cat?
not really a good insight, but it was an insight, a good idea. Because if I get a cat, the cat will chase the mice away. And that means I won't have to spend all this time sewing my ropes. So she went to the village and said, anyone got a spare cat? And it's always easy to get spare cats, always having kittens. And so she got a little kitten, a very nice little cute little kitten, and to keep the mice away. And then she thought, okay, now I can have some more time to meditate. But then she thought, well, I've got to feed the cat, and maybe the cat doesn't like, you know, rice and vegetables. So she had to take a little container with her on arms round to get some milk for the cat. And every now and again, some fish as well. And so she was always asking the people for some milk and some fish for the cat, especially some milk. And then after a while, she thought, this is just so troublesome, carrying all this milk for the cat to keep the mouse away so I don't need to patch my robes. So he said, well, what if I get a cow? Because if I have a cow, then I won't have to ask for any milk anymore. Got my own cow. So she asked, and it was a big festival day, so they did a big collection for her to make some merit so they could offer a cow to the nun so she could get her own milk to feed the cat to keep the mouse away so she didn't need to patch her robe. So she got the cow, but then now she didn't need to go ask for any milk, but she had to get some grass. So every day she had a rice bowl and a big lot of grass to feed her cow. And that was just really sort of troublesome, to get the grass to feed the cow, to get the milk to feed the cat to keep the mouse away so she didn't need to patch her robes. And so she thought, well, it'd be much more convenient if instead of having to ask for grass every day, if I get my own field. You know, because I've got some really wealthy supporters who are doing well, and so she asked them, well, would you mind just collecting? Oh, we're very happy to make merit. It's a very good opportunity for us to do some good karma. So they got some money together and got a field, so she can put the cow in the field so to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away so she didn't need to patch her ropes. But, you know, even so, still, you know, having to go to the field to milk the cow and to make sure it was well tethered and the gates were locked and everything else, and it's just a lot of work. So I said, why don't I get an attendant, a young boy? Because if, you know, and the deal was, you know, that some of the young boys, you know, 11, 12, 13 years of age were a bit of a handful, being naughty. And, you know, by looking after the bhikkhuni, the nun, they'll be associating with a good person, and the nun would actually influence the kid to be a much better moral person, to be a bit more respectful to the parents and a bit more obedient. And in return, the kid would do the jobs, you know, for the bhikkhuni. So it was very easy to get sort of a naughty boy in the village. In fact, they were all sort of want to give two or three of them, get rid of them. But anyway, she chose one who became the attendant, who would look after the field, so they could have a cow to provide the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mice away, so it didn't need to keep patching the ropes. But then the boy needed some place to stay. And you can't have, like, the boy staying in the same cave as the nun. So she said, okay, well, you know, just do this and get it over with. She asked the people to build a little hut at the front of the cave for the boy to stay in, to look after the field, to provide grass for the cow, to get milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away so she didn't need to patch her ropes. And so they started building this hut for the boy. And then one day, you know, they came to her and they wanted to ask a question on meditation. She said, I'm sorry, I've got no time. I've got to supervise the building of the hut, to house the boy, to look after the field, to house the cow, to get the milk, to feed the cat, to keep the mouse away, so I don't have to spend so much time patching my robes. And then she thought, oh, what have I got myself into? She realized that's called materialism. We always think if I get this, and then it will be much more convenient. So what she did, she said, apologized, and she went and told all the builders to take all the building material back. She sent the boy back to his house. He sold the cow and the field. She got rid of the cat and gave it a good home. And then she had nothing to worry about except when she went to arms round, when she came back, the mouse had come back too and bitten another hole in her robe. And quite peacefully and happily, she sewed another patch into her robe. Do you get the idea? I won. When I get this, then I'll be happy. Just one more cushion. I'll be happy. Whatever it is. Just had a point last night. Why do we not have to eat in the evening? Why can't we just have a meal in the evening? I said, well, Ajahn Brahm doesn't really know. You know, what I bring in my suitcases and what I put in my room in the evening. I don't know how much contraband you have in your rooms. Just one pack of noodles and that'll be fine. But anyway, you can see that what's happening there. So it takes some wisdom actually to see things like that. What am I doing this for? Do you think that when I get this, then I'll be happy? It's wanting. Saying, when I get jhana, then I'll be happy. When I get enlightened, then I'll be happy. Stop it. Stop wanting. As a great philosopher said, and it could have been the Buddha, but he's just put it in other words, when you want something more, you can't enjoy what you already have. When you want the next stage of meditation, you can't enjoy the stage you're having now. Even you get nimittas, it's not good enough. I want the real nimittas, not these, ordinary nimittas. I want more. First jhana, no, I want the second jhana. Yeah, first jhana, been there, done that. I want the real one. All of that, there's no end to wanting. But actually, you can't get a jhana if you've got wanting. So you learn how to let go of wanting. This is good enough for me. Sit here perfect and content. That's what the wisdom is. The wisdom, the insight, teaches you the path of contentment. Just like we chanted every morning and evening, this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness. May you be contented and easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding in nature, not demanding to get nimittas, just content with being a sleepy, dull old monk. Contented and easy satisfied, not demanding in nature. That is the cause of great states of mind. When you try, you block. When you let go, you open out. And this is a wonderful path. This is the insight. And it's really insight because it does actually open you out to really deep, peaceful states. And I've been trying. But every now and again, I just give up. How many of you, a couple of you already said in interviews, you're sitting here not getting anywhere. Well, getting a little way, but not really much. And then you just go to bed. As you lay down, incredible nimittas come up. So peaceful. Why? It's because you're letting go. You think you're letting go here, but you're not really letting go. Letting go, come on, something happened. Come on, letting go, where's the paycheck? Come on. But when you go to sleep, okay, you give up. That's why we introduce at this stage the Ananda method of enlightenment. This is a classic story. Ananda was the attendant of the Buddha for 25 years. 25 years was doing duties for his boss. And when it came to the Buddha passed away, Ananda was still not enlightened. He said, oh my goodness, he can't get enlightened sitting next to the greatest teacher for 25 years. All these other people were coming up, they're getting enlightened, and this one was getting enlightened, this another one was getting enlightened, he was just sitting there and just, when's my turn going to happen? And the Buddha passed away and he's still not enlightened. That was really depressing. And to understand what it might be like, just, you know, get a little bit of empathy, just a little bit of idea. Imagine at the end of this retreat, when I made the announcement of all the 60 people on this retreat and a few hangers-on, all of you were enlightened, fully arahat, psychic powers of works, except for one of you, and that was you. That would be just so disappointing. Oh, all these other people enlightened and not me, and I'm a nun. Oh. Oh. So, that's what Ananda felt like. And he was just really sort of depressed and upset and just... But anyway, what happened next was the monks and nuns decided to get like a convocation together to actually to get all the teachings together, you know, to amass them, because one person heard this, one person said that, to have this in a big conference, 500 arahats, fully enlightened beings. That's what they wanted. But then they thought of Ananda. Yeah, he wasn't enlightened, but, you know, he sat next to the Buddha, he had so much experience, he'd heard so much. So they made an exception. 499 arahats plus the odd one out, Ananda. So the next day he was going to go to a meeting with all his friends. Now they had all passed the highest levels and he was still just, you know, grade one, whatever it was. So he felt just, right, tonight's the night. I really am going to meditate. I'm going to crack it tonight. So the night before the conference, he meditated all night. Really gave it everything he got, 100%. And when dawn came up in the morning, nowhere. Still wasn't enlightened. And that was just really disappointing. He'd given it everything he got and just, it didn't work. So he looked at the clock. It was another hour before the conference was about to start. So what did he do? He'd been up all night. He took a nap. He went to his room and he went to lay down. And that is when it happened. That's when his paycheck came. When he wasn't expecting it, when he wasn't trying. Just before his head hit the pillow, he became the 500th enlightened member of that convocation. And he had to convince all his friends he was really enlightened, so he deliberately came late. They waited for him, wasn't there, so to, you know, to keep the quiet, they locked the door. And about 5 minutes after locking the door, Ananda came in through the keyhole. As I say, it's called making an entrance. Do his psychic power stuff. And said, yeah, welcome. Another arahat, you done it, well done. Now you're one of the boys, one of the gang, one of the girls, whatever it was there. One of the gang. So, but interesting, that's how he became enlightened. Is a classic, well known, I'll just elaborate a bit here, a little bit there. But actually, the going through the keyhole was part of the story. But the point was that he gave up. He let go. He renounced any sort of aspiration to become enlightened. So he let go. And before his head hit the pillow, he became enlightened. So we call that the Ananda method of enlightenment, which is one of the other reasons I ask you when you're tired to go and take a nap. Because the more times you sort of hit the pillow, you're increasing the probability that that might happen to you. The Ananda method of enlightenment. It was, oh yeah, that's a good method of meditation. I'll get into that one. But what it does mean is you are just relaxing, letting go, making peace. And that's incredible insight. Why are, you know, that, you know, you're smart people. You know that you've heard a lot. Why isn't it going deeper? Because you're trying too hard. You're wanting. Just let go. You can't be still in the next moment. You're still in this moment. The only way you can be still in this moment is just let go of the future moments. Stop striving. Stop hoping. Stop trying to get somewhere. Stop craving. Stop wanting. Just be in this moment. This is good enough for me. I'll just finish off. I mentioned this already, but it fits in here. about that little play acting, role playing of being a Buddha. I think that was the first night, wasn't it? I said, it's a brilliant little piece of meditation, skillful means. So next time you meditate, whether it's, you know, just on a chair or on a cushion or somewhere, you close your eyes and you role play. The reason I started this was, again, it's in Singapore, they had this little gems group. The kids, it was a play school. And they invited me there to teach. And I thought, oh my goodness, how do you teach little kids? Because it was like the WASAC time. And so, you know, just trying to innovate. Because, you know, you can't sit and teach people, kids how to meditate. Okay, sit down, close your eyes, watch your breath. Yeah, sure. So I said, WASAC. So, in the story, the traditional story of the Buddha, WASAC, when he came out of his mum's womb, he walked 7 steps, and he put up his finger, I am, this is my last birth, I am the chief. He said, okay, this is what you do, now all do that. And then we'll go into that, you know, just walking 7 steps. I am the chief, this is my last life. Great. So they play-acted like the Buddha's birth in Lumbini. So next one. Is sitting under the Bodhi tree, becoming enlightened. So sit down, imagine you're the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Imagine there, you're just sitting there, and you're getting all this incredible. And they could imagine, kids imagine it's great, and they just sat there pretending to be the Buddha. And then, okay, next one, the teaching, actually that wasn't on the WASAC day, but passing away under the twin sal trees at Kusinara. So you've got to lie on your right side, so all the kids lie on their right side. But this, and now close your eyes, and now you're the Buddha passing away. They really got into it, especially the last one when they're passing away, because that took about 5 or 10 minutes, and a nice bit of peace and quiet. But what it told me, it just, because I remembered, I don't know if you went, I remember being at school, primary school, and pretending you're a tree. You know, imagine, you put your hands out, you're a tree swaying in the wind. And even now you can do that, you really get into it, I'm a tree swaying in the wind. The idea of practicing, so now let's do something interesting. Pretend you're a Buddha, already enlightened, sitting there in China Grove Meditation Hall, sitting here, nothing to do. You've achieved everything, fully enlightened. Nothing more to do, nothing more to achieve, no bosses, no problems anymore. Your desk is totally free of all telephones or emails. You're finished, you're done. No more work. Totally complete. Nothing more to be done, nothing more to achieve. Sit there and imagine what that must be like. And you imagine you role play and get into it. My Buddha sitting here. Totally free, nothing to do. That's so cool. I had to stop myself because if I went any further, I wouldn't open my eyes. I miss all of the interviews. Give that a try. Imagine you're a Buddha. All that does is get you in the moment. No desires, no wanting, no ill will, nothing to do. You're free. You're perfect. You're a Buddha. Yay! See what it's like. It's a great skillful means. It's an insight which causes peace. And the peace creates more insights. And the insights create more peace. And the peace creates more insights. And then you get so much insight and you get the jhanas. And it's jhana and it's wisdom. Bang! Another enlightened being. Sadhu. 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 Okay, very good. So now I'm going to imagine role play being a CIA interrogator for your interviews.